Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are all about helping entrepreneurs to succeed. Entrepreneurs helping entrepreneurs is our message, is our game, is the action that we take. And today we're going to be highlighting an incredible story, one that you probably don't know. You probably don't know that the founder of the great car company we know as Tesla is actually from Sacramento. He's the co-founder of Tesla. He's from Sacramento. He has had a tremendous career, and he's since left Tesla. We're going to talk today about his time recruiting Elon Musk, and also what he's doing today in helping entrepreneurs in the way of venture capital. So stick around, my friends. I think you're going to love today's show. I now have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to share the story of Mark Tarpening. He is the co-founder of Tesla. Yes, the Tesla, the automotive company. As most of you probably thought Elon Musk was the guy. Well, back when Tesla started, Mark and his partner began what we now know as probably the most prolific automotive company on the planet. And well, Mark, thank you very much. I didn't really know how to introduce you other than the founder of Tesla, but now you're doing venture capital and you've got a story that's beyond this. So when people ask you, so what do you do for a living? What do you say?
Well, first off, thank you. It's great to be on your show. And that was quite the introduction. What do I say? Well, frequently I kind of say, I don't know what I'm doing, because that's kind of the normal status that I'm in.
Sorry to interrupt you. When people go, when you say, yeah, I was the co-founder of Tesla, do people go like, BS? No way, right? Because, you know, just ordinary guy, super humble. You and I have talked and it's like, wow, this guy founded Tesla? What a sweet man. What a nice guy.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a strange but true fact. But yes, so Martin Eberhard and I started it in 2003.
Okay, so what I would like to do today is to sort of share some of that story, if you can. I know there's, you know, maybe a lot of us have big dreams, maybe not as big as the Tesla dream, but trying to imagine what it might have been like there. Because a lot of early stage companies, right? There's so many, and we all dream about building something beyond where it's at today. So maybe, would you mind just giving us a little bit of the history, and maybe I can kind of probe a little bit on
what
the emotions might have been like in being that person, especially as you began to see it succeed.
Yeah, well, that's the crazy part. So Martin Eberhard and I started in 2003 on July 1st, and which was a mistake, as it turns out. We were banging on the lawyers to get the paperwork in before the 4th of July weekend. And they, you know, did, and they got it in, and we got it, you know, great. So we were all pleased. And about 2 years later, as Nikola Tesla, who the company is named after, became sort of, you know, Nikola Tesla has always been, you know, a hero of the geek community. If you're in engineering, everybody knows about him, but it was not well known outside that community. So as he became more well known, we discovered, and the UN actually created Tesla Day or something, and it was on his birthday, which is July 10th. And if we had known, it never occurred to us to look for when his birthday was, you know, to create the company on that day, which we would have done if we had known. Anyway, that's an aside. So we started the company, and we did all the things that you normally do when you start a company. You know, filed the paperwork. We put in a little bit of money into it. At that time, people actually like went to offices. It was something that people did. It's hard to remember that now, but that was a thing then. So we rented a small office in Menlo Park, which was from this crazy landlord who was wonderful. And it's a very small office just for the two of us, because we found that if we were trying to do stuff and I had little kids at home and, you know, it just wasn't as, it didn't work as well hanging out entirely in cafes. Rented this little office and spent about six, almost 9 months working on the business plan, trying to figure out if it was even possible to do. Because, you know, a car company sounded pretty insane. Martin was the one that was really, you know, pushing for the car company. I it took, he had to convince me that it made sense. And along the way, we learned a lot about, whether it would or not, whether we could really do it or not. And by December of 2003, we were pretty convinced it was quite exciting. So we started, got our deck all ready and tried to raise some money. By that time, we had put in a couple hundred thousand. We had, done some experiments to know that these lithium ion batteries that we were familiar with were really going to scale the way we expected them to, which was one of the big proof points to see if we could really make cars perform the way we thought we could. And we then showed the deck to some VCs that we knew wouldn't invest. They were friends of ours that we sort of knew through other channels. And we said, we got this crazy idea. We know your fund can't invest in it, but can we give you, can we show it to you and get some feedback? And that turned out to be super valuable to sort of hone our pitch. And they gave us some great feedback, which actually changed our business model a little bit. And then in January, we started shaking the money trees. And it was through that process, we got a couple small VCs to say yes. And, the typical sort of friends, family, and angels. And then we were looking for, a lead investor when we came across Elon down in Los Angeles.
How much longer was that? So you start, I'm picturing this. So January, you go out there, friends, family, angels. What valuation did you have on the company then?
Oh, I don't remember.
Is that confidential stuff?
Yeah, it's still confidential.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No.
It was not very high because it was only a slide deck and this really crazy idea. And we were going to need a whole ton of money. So, we were overly optimistic to get that Roadster out, but we still needed millions and millions, tens of millions, many tens of millions of dollars to do that. So, we were going to have to give up a lot of the company in order to make that happen. And that's just these capital intensive things. That's just the way it is. And then, so we went down and pitched Elon. We got an intro to him, went down and pitched him. And that was probably March, I would guess.
It was early on then. Okay.
Yeah. We thought it might take 6 months to raise money. And it ended up, we had the round closed by the middle of April. And I can't remember the exact date it closed, but it was actually an important date because Elon, when he said, we went down, pitched him, which was totally fun because he had just started SpaceX the year before. So it was great pitching him because unlike, you pitch these VCs and you say, oh, we're going to do electric sports cars. The VC behind the desk is like going, the guy's crazy. Okay, well, be polite and try to escort him out. And then you go down and we're pitching Elon and he's building a rocket ship behind him. Like, so we're pitching it in the office behind the window. They're building a rocket ship. So like the idea of a crazy venture, like we were so not crazy in that context. And Elon was like, oh, I get this. This sounds great. I'm really into decarbonizing the planet's energy supply. Transportation is a big part of that. I'm in. So it took a little bit longer than that. But then he had twins. He says, but I have twins coming by cesarean section. So I know the date when my twins are arriving. I need to have it closed before the twins arrive because I'll be super busy. so we had to really get the paperwork done quickly.
So he sort of came on, I'm just saying this as a question, as kind of like an angel investor. When did he become, I guess, kind of active in the company? How did that progress?
So he was the lead investor of Series A, which would have been seed now, but at the time it was called Series A. So he was the lead of that and was chairman of the board, because you have to have somebody and he obviously, should be chairman. And he was, very supportive board member always, he really got the mission. He really, focused on the mission, but he was a board member. So we'd see him once a month for board meetings. And that was probably for the first 4 years, I would guess, really. I mean, he was probably more involved. He was more involved than the other board members just because he was a larger shareholder and was more into the mission. And then as the Roadster was, had been delayed and we had this terrible supply problem with one of our component vendors, which we just did not anticipate. It was a car part. It was something we thought the car industry could deliver without. It was not on our radar that this would be nearly killing the company anyway, but it nearly did. So it was around that time as we were getting the Roadsters, as we were really beginning to ship the Roadsters, or trying to ship the Roadsters, that we started looking for, and by this time we had about 300 employees, probably. I'm forgetting a little bit, but somewhere around there. And we were looking for a new CEO. We're actively looking, actively interviewing, and thought we had one, and then that person pulled out at the last minute, and the board decided that they'd appoint an interim CEO and replace my co-founder, Martin. And there's a bunch of press around that, and you can, you know, read that. I'm not going to get into the details there. So then we had Michael Marks as CEO. And by this time, Elon is pretty involved because the company is in trouble, right? It's one of his portfolio companies that he really cares about. He's invested a whole ton of money into it. And it's you know, we're having these problems. And Michael Marks, who is the former CEO of Flextronics, super great guy, knows everything about manufacturing, was really, really helpful. Unfortunately, he had his own gig that he was starting, you know, in the fall. And he said, I can only do this for a few months. You know, like I'm going to be done. You know, I've got to be done. So he left, and then the board appointed Zeb Drory, who was the former founder of Monolithic Memories, or who was the founder of Monolithic Memories, as CEO. And he was not an ideal fit for the company, I didn't think. And that's about when I left. It was a little after that. But the board was really into him. And then I don't know what happened, but a couple months later, he was ousted, and Elon became the CEO. So Elon's the fourth CEO of Tesla. But that was a great transition. I mean, he had always been super supportive. So it was the right thing.
So now you're a venture capitalist today. And I'm wondering what similarities you might see in Tesla, in the early days of Tesla, and maybe with companies you look at today. Are you looking for companies that look like the next, I mean, who wouldn't want to invest in the next Tesla, but is that the kind of, I mean, is that a Tesla in many ways is like an anomaly? How do you spot the next Tesla?
Well, I wish we knew. I mean, I think every VC dreams of, you know, hitting one of these things out of the park like that. And it's really unclear as to, you know, because companies, there's so many barriers, you know, starting a company and being successful is so hard, as you know, that, you know, is this going to be the company that somehow is able to overcome all those things, that has the right mix of technology and product market fit and team and flexibility? And, you know, like, it's super hard to figure that out. So yeah, we see many companies that I look at and go, wow, you know, that could be the next big one, but, you know, what do they really have going on? And I don't know if we would ever fund, if Tesla had walked in the door, I'm not sure that we would have funded us.
Right. All right. So I'm going to kind of stay on the early days of Tesla, because I think a lot of people, you know, I think the majority of our audience, and I guess the majority of people who are thinking entrepreneurship really are in these earlier stage companies. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of early stage companies and a lot of people that dream about having a company that can get to a million in sales, let alone be worth, you know, hundreds of billions or trillions. You know, there's so few that everybody's sort of down here at the bottom. But so we're living that. These were emotionally connected. Me is more of an angel investor, but we're emotionally connected to these early stage companies and the founders that run them. So you and your business partner, super successful in landing the right group of investors, including Elon Musk, or especially Elon. I mean, are there any lessons in there that you think about for maybe the average Joe entrepreneur here who's got a potential rocket ship on their hands, but just doesn't, you know, hasn't got out of their own way yet?
Well, one thing that we look for, and I'm a big believer in, is, sorry about that. One thing we look for that, you know, it's a cliche, but having a mission aligned founder is super important. And that's something that, you know, Tesla had. I mean, Martin and I were really committed to the bigger vision of what we were doing in terms of electrifying transportation. as was Elon. You know, so we had our major investor, the chairman of the board, wasn't in it just for the money. You know, he was in it for this much bigger vision of changing the energy, as he would say, I want to change the energy equation of the US, you know, of the world ultimately, but of the US, you know, first. And that was really helpful. So, and we do occasionally, so it's one of the things we look for is the, you know, as the founding team, do they actually really care about their product, or are they just in it because they think there might be some money in it?
Yeah.
And likewise, you want to, as an entrepreneur, you want to find investors that are mission aligned as well. You know, that obviously they're ultimately in it for the money. The investors, that's typically, you know, what they're supposed to be doing, but you want them to care about the mission in some way, because they're going to be more supportive. They're going to have more connections in that industry, if nothing else.
Yeah, and we think about that. So thinking about how to find that, how to tell the difference between a mission-aligned investor and a somebody who's just in it for the money. Obviously, they have their mission statements. These VCs, I'm investing into a couple that focus on promoting social causes and so on. I'm investing in a different venture capital company. But my mission is all around Sacramento. So I think anybody who knows me knows, hey, Mark loves his hometown, entrepreneurship, anything around building. It could be a restaurant or a software company. I love my hometown. That's mm-hmm. what I'm all about. Others may be around saving the planet or electrifying automotive. But I guess my question is, like, if I'm a founder, right, and I find that co-founder that, and we're aligned in that way, that's a huge step. But then what I see is people who are just going out there looking for money, right? And rarely do you see, or do I see, I should say, people who are looking strategically, especially when they're in these early stages, and being able to say no to people writing checks because I'm kind of holding out for the right guy or the right woman, the right investor. Because and I also wonder, is that possible to find in a venture capital company, or is that, hey, is an Elon Musk, is that commitment level available in a venture capital, venture capital firm?
Yeah. So again, those are two separate questions, and I'll answer both of them. The first one is, is there, you know, you're starting out, you're trying to find money, and do you just take any check that comes in? Every round that we ever raised in the two companies that Martin and I founded and raised a whole ton of money on, we would have our preferred list of investors that we thought would be the firms and stuff that we thought would be good to work with. And in the end, we always accepted whatever check came in first. I like, you know, because we raising money is really hard. So I love this idea of really thinking about it. But on the other hand, ultimately, in order to survive, in order to grow the business, you got to take some money. And so we have never had the luxury of selecting. With Elon, we essentially got lucky in that we found somebody who was willing to take the risk because they believed so much in the vision, at Tesla. But once the company has some traction, once it's actually moving, then things change a little bit, because then we had VC firms that were specifically interested in energy, in transportation, in electrification coming at us. And those were all the money sort of spends the same way, but those were great partners because they had more to bring. All VCs say they have more, they bring more to the table than just their check. But rarely do they really, but sometimes they do have these deep connections into an industry, which can be really helpful for introductions, especially into supplier networks. We had, obviously issues with suppliers. So, I mean, just because it's hard to break into that. So, although I will say our investors didn't help us too much with the suppliers because they didn't have a lot of auto experience. But, and then the second aspect of that is, you know, are VCs as committed to their portfolio companies? They certainly can be. It depends on the firm. Some firms just write checks, which is fine. And they'll say, you know, they'll always say, oh, we're special. But in the end, when you ask them, like, what do you provide? You know, they'll say, oh, we just write checks. Other firms have whole, you know, sort of a candy store of assistance. You know, they have executive coaching and they have marketing help and they have PR agencies that can help. And some of that is gratis, you know, to the portfolio. Some of that is at a discount. So it, you know, it definitely depends on the firm and what extra value they bring. And if you're an entrepreneur and you have a choice, you should ask, you know, what can we expect from you? Frequently, you don't have that choice, but
that's what I've seen more of. And I sort of wonder, and I've read a few things that talk about, if you're going to raise money, if you're going to build a business and the idea is you're going to end up going out for venture capital, if you're going to build that type of business, the only place to do it is in the Silicon Valley or in the Bay Area, because that's, you know, all the money, all the connections and. But I guess that's the follow-up question is, besides the industry expertise that you found in some of these VCs and in Elon in terms of commitment, how important or how valuable is it to be geographically located in some place like the Silicon Valley or San Francisco or I don't know. I guess if you're making movies, maybe you want to be in Hollywood.
Well, that's a very good analogy. In that, if you're really serious about movie making, you sort of end up in Hollywood no matter what. Like you end up in LA, and I think that in some ways the tech industry is the same way around Silicon Valley. I would have said that really strongly up until COVID hit, and now I'm not sure what that means, because all the pitches that we see are by Zoom, and they're from all over the place. You know, there's no, you know, we don't particularly have. At Sparrow, we really only invest in North America, you know, for other reasons that have nothing to do with, you know, the you know, a time zone or anything. But where exactly that is not nearly as important as it was 6 months ago. So I think this is actually a really interesting opportunity for companies to be able to raise money from locations that might not normally be on the radar of the venture capitalist, because you know, before you had to come to Silicon Valley somewhere, you had to come to San Francisco or to Sand Hill Road or whatever and pitch and then be available. And they wanted to come and see. Now, you know, it's all by Zoom.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think about, okay, you have a Sacramento connection, I see this as my hometown. And so you think about localism and driving local economies, economic growth for a region. And when an entrepreneur succeeds, it's great for the whole town, from jobs to, you know, the tax base and so on. There's a lot of reasons we want entrepreneurship to work in our hometown. But if you want to go out and really build a big company, you better go to the Silicon Valley or Hollywood, or, you know, to go to the right place. Well, you know, it makes me sort of wonder about the advantage, right? So I've got this premise, and maybe I'll have you either, you know, say it's valid or slightly valid, but I've got this premise that if you're surrounded by people who care about you for who you are, because you're a good old Marky from down on the block, and we want to help you out, that's an advantage, almost like maybe going to Sac State and somehow being good enough and you're playing for the Kings and you end up, you know, the crowd, everybody loves you, a crowd favorite if that were to happen. So like, how can there be an advantage in staying in your hometown and maybe growing your business in your hometown versus traveling away to, you know, the tech capital of the world or the movie making capital of the world? Gosh, with COVID, people now being able to do Zoom calls in their sleep, can we do it that way? And really, you know, I built some smaller companies and I did it with my buddies I went to high school with and that kind of thing. And you can build cool companies where there's a loyalty and that loyalty and commitment and friendship, that's really kind of the differentiator versus, some of the other things. Again, never built anything where the scale we've been talking about, but I'm wondering, is there anything valid about building something in your hometown and finding an advantage out of that?
Oh, I think so, definitely. First of all, I just want to say that the idea of doing Zoom calls in my sleep, it's like, that would be a nightmare. Like I'm already on Zoom enough, right?
No doubt.
Yeah, but I think there is an advantage, but it is a thing of scale. So, you know, we have invested in the past in companies that are, you know, in some, you know, somewhat distant location. And if they get successful, there is a tendency for them to come into, to get closer to Silicon Valley. And the reason for that is finding talent. Now, this may all be different now. I mean, this really big transition that we've just made, and whether or not we can really be productive this way is still a little unclear. But, you know, it's one thing if you're really growing like crazy, and you need, oh my gosh, I need another, you know, 1,000 engineers or 500, you know, data engineers or whatever. That's going to be a little hard to find outside of Silicon Valley, is the thing.
Interesting question. So yeah, so you think about this, and maybe it's too soon to tell. My daughter's the president. She's a realtor, successful realtor, president of the Realtors Association here. And you know Sacramento well enough, and our audience knows. You know, I'm sort of in the suburbs. I'm in Rockland, but Roseville, Loomis. Didn't you grow up in like El Dorado? No, you were in Sacramento.
I grew up right by Fair Oaks and Watt Avenue.
Okay, Sacramento. But your brother is here, right? Isn't your brother like in El Dorado Hills or?
Yeah, Loomis. Yeah.
Oh, he's in Loomis. Okay, so, what I'm seeing as somebody who's sort of a residential real estate aficionado, people are coming in here in droves, looking for a little more room, a different, I call it quality of life, but a different type of lifestyle. And the prices of houses are escalating quickly here in Placer County. And I'm wondering, is this more of a little bit of a longer term trend that might make this engineering blight, right? Hey, I need my 400 engineers. Heck, let's all go to Roseville. Let's all go to, you know, El Dorado Hills.
This could be really a turning point. I mean, I think it is possible that when we look back, you know, 20 years from now, this will be this inflection point where location stopped making as big of a difference. And that has pluses and minuses. Part of what makes a place like Silicon Valley or Los Angeles, for that matter, special for those industries is the serendipity effect, where you're literally, you know, talking to somebody, you know, at Starbucks, and somebody at the table next to you says, "Hey, I couldn't help but overhear, you know, we're really interested in that, you know, our company needs that thing," and that happens all the time here because of the concentration of this kind of industry, just like in Los Angeles around movies and scripts and production and stuff. So there, I suspect that's going to be difficult in a really distributed world. That said, the companies, when they need those extra engineers, where those engineers are, you know, may not matter so much anymore, because the tools are still crummy, but they may be good enough to make it all kind of work out. And I really do think, you know, the tools are going to get better and better and better. So this might be the moment where your physical location, especially if you're a knowledge worker of some kind, is not nearly as important as it used to be.
Be interesting to see. And again, we're still in the early stages of this, but how will these engineers, how might they cluster, right? So headquarters might be in Palo Alto, but you have a cluster in Sacramento, a cluster, who knows, Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, right, or something like that. Who knows? It makes me sort of wonder.
You know, we've had a long history of, you know, certain outsourced, you know, to India specifically, you know, for years, and that didn't work super well. But I think this is a different thing. You know, the tools are different, the level of people are different, in terms of the education, the time zones are a lot tighter. Although we had a portfolio company interviewing a bunch of people, and they hired two people that are awesome, and one of them, and so it's not just, you know, moving out to Placerville, you know, like they were looking for engineers around here, but the engineer they really liked was in South America. So they're like, you know, we haven't been to the office in 6 months. Sure, we'll do that. We might be in a new world where the competition is also a little bit more intense for a lot of these positions. And, you know, because they literally had no trouble, you know, there was some legal issues about getting all the paperwork right. But I mean, that person's, you know, working from South America very effectively. And so I do, this might be a real transition in what's possible. But as all these things, the sort of running it forward, the ramifications of it are super hard to figure out. You know, where will there be clusters and will they go global?
So, you know, people are probably wondering, why am I not staying on the early days of Tesla? And we're kind of philosophizing a little bit, but it's because you're a visionary. In order to, you know, do something like Tesla and be that founder, it puts you in a position to see things that most people can't see. And I do think that you're somebody that we can look to, that some of your predictions, I think, might come true, right? They probably have a lot better chance of coming true than maybe others. So as you start to think about, but I also want to make sure that our early stage investors and, you know, entrepreneurs get a chance to hear things that might be something that they can relate to help grow their business or make the right investment. So maybe we'll stay in the entrepreneurial track. Any advice to entrepreneurs? So you're talking about raising money and, you know, just take the check, but look strategically. Any other thoughts toward the person who's out there right now raising money and, you know, things, mistakes, things you wish you wouldn't have done, things that you can say, do this all day long, that maybe things that people haven't thought about?
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, that's a very broad, like there's so many things. You know, it's again, you know, cliche, but, you know, customer really matters. You know, at our previous company and at Tesla, we really were focused on the customer, you know, the customer experience. And that included once they bought the product, because we had a multi-year, you know, 2.5 years, I guess, or 2 years between when the people bought the Roadster to the time they first got the delivery, and to bring them along on that journey without losing them. You know, you have to be really, you know, focused on the customer. I'm a big believer in co-founders, and I, you know, obviously there are many companies that are super successful with a single founder, but I couldn't imagine doing it as a single founder, just because first off, you know, being an entrepreneur is really manic depressive, you know, because there's all those times where you know you're going to rule the world, and then there's other times where you know that it's the stupidest idea ever, and like, why did anyone give us any money? And like, you know, it's just hopeless. And if you have a co-founder, hopefully they're desynchronized from you enough that, you know, when you come back and you go, we're doomed, they come back that day and say, I just had a great customer meeting, we are just going to take over the world. And I really think that having that other person to balance you out is super helpful.
So two is better than one. Is three better than two?
I don't know. I've only done it with, you know, but, you know, all of these things, you know, the sample set is really low, so it's hard to extrapolate. But I just personally just don't have I don't have the personality to be able to do it alone. I guess is perhaps it.
As an investor, you're looking for that chemistry, I'm sure, between the between founders. You see a couple of founders, maybe it's three. What do you look for, or do you do anything specific to kind of demonstrate to yourself that there's a bond like what you and your co-founder had?
No, you know, we try to get to know the founders to some degree. You know, we do, you know, spend time with them both, obviously before the investment, and really try to understand what value they're adding. And also, you know, we obviously would be a little nervous if it appeared that one of the co-founders was, you know, much weaker in some sense than the other one, you know, because then you kind of wonder as the company grows how that's going to work out. But generally, most of the time, we find that they're well matched. You know, like it's they bring complementary skills. It's a funny thing, is it is almost always, at least in my experience, it's complement. Martin and I are very different, but you know, collectively we function reasonably well. The company that I was at before, it was actually a husband and wife team, and together they made a single pretty awesome, you know, operating unit. But individually, you know, they would say, you know, we each have our strengths and weaknesses, and they were quite good at managing that. So I do think it, you know, how do we evaluate that? I mean, then you're in a little bit of the sort of art where you're trying to figure out, are these the founders that are really going to be able to take the company, you know, forward? And that's very hard to quantify in any real sense.
Okay, so with your investor hat, we'll stay on this track for a little bit. Sparrow has a focus. Could you describe your investment thesis?
Sure. So Sparrow has three themes that we invest in. One is the health of people and planet. So things like, you know, digital health or things that work on, you know, climate change or pollution or, you know, health of people and planet. The other one is around building real communities. So not so much Facebook-like communities, but things that actually really bring people together. Because we've, you know, obviously this is a little bit of a problem right now, you know, in our COVID time. But before COVID, we really believed that people needed to be together, and that technology that made that easier or better, that created authentic connections, would be valuable always. Like people would really gravitate to that. And then the next category, the last category, is a much broader category, and that's sort of the future of work and of work and purpose, because people really want to have jobs that have meaning. You know, they don't just want to do the same thing forever and never advance. In general, people want to have meaning in their life through work. So things that upskill, for example, you know, Skillshare is one of our investments that does that, where they people who are good at something can create classes and the other people can take them, and it's all vetted and controlled and is quite successful that way. And that's an example where it's both creating community and it is allowing, you know, sort of people to share their expertise and be compensated for that and upskill other people along the way. So those are kind of the big investment themes. We don't do things where the users of the product and the customers and the people paying for it, if you will, are misaligned. And it, an example of that is in most of the ad tech kinds of companies, you know, you as the user of the product tend to be their product. You know, Google bundles us up and sells us to advertisers. I mean, they sell us to their Google's customers. You know, are the people selling product, we're not their customer. And we find that companies that have that kind of split business model just don't align with their, it's not aligned with the users. It always ends up hurting the user in some way. So we just want to invest in those.
What about like age and stage of the company? Are you looking for a very early stage?
No.
Where would you like to come in?
Yeah, it's a really good point. We write $1 to $3 million checks into rounds that are typically, I don't know, 5 to 10 million kind of ish. I mean, you know, all of these are sort of the general rules because there's always some exceptions. We really like to see some sort of product market fit. And the ideal form of that is revenue. You know, that's the gold standard of product market fit. If people are buying your product, yeah, you know that you've hit something good. We don't, we do, you know, some pre-revenue companies if they can show that there's a demand for their product, that the product's going to be successful once they get it out or whatever. But it is obviously a harder lift. They have to show that product market fit. So we really like to see revenue. That's a big, you know, big part of it.
So then when you come into a company, it's an early stage company, and then walk me through like the life cycle of one of your companies, because maybe you don't have to use one specifically necessarily, but you come in, how long do you stay invested typically? You write it out? Are you looking for,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. How does that work? Because you're going on for a follow-on round. Let's say you got coming to Series A, then you got the B and the C and, you know, all this. What happens to you guys along the way?
Yeah, well, at some point, we will be priced out of follow-on rounds in a sense. But we'll certainly do, if the company is meeting its metrics, if things are going well, and we're pretty supportive of our portfolio companies. So we would certainly, we'll invest in the next round, the Series B or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. At some point, it becomes sort of outside of our, portfolio range, and it becomes ridiculous, when they're raising, hundreds of millions of dollars or something, and, we write our little tiny check. The new investors aren't particularly excited about that either.
Well, I always wondered that. But, so how much do you set aside for, say, follow-on investing? So you've got, let's say, I don't know if you want to give specific on the size of your fund, but do you leave 10% in the kitty so you can make some follow-on investments for your success?
Oh, it's much more than that. Unfortunately, not all of our investments have follow-ons. We would love them all to have follow-ons. Not all of them do. We could follow on more than, because there are some failures along the way, there's sort of more money available for the follow-ons potentially for the ones that are successful. And we're $100 million fund would be the way we think about it.
And you look at how do you spread that out? Is that going to be 10 companies? Is that 20 companies in a fund?
So it varies a little bit. So we, if you think about it, it's, if $100 million, let's say over 4 years, about $25 million a year. And if we're writing, $1 to $3 million checks, you can kind of work out. It's a handful of companies. It's not a lot. But there's follow-on money. We have to reserve, follow-on money. So as most firms, and this is why raising money is so, you have to have the right expectations. When you come into a VC fund or a firm and you pitch, almost always they're going to say no. Because even the big firms, they only write, a handful of checks a year. I mean, the big firms probably write 100 checks a year or whatever, but they see thousands and thousands of pitches in that time. And we certainly see, hundreds and hundreds of pitches for every one that we write the check for. But there's a lot of firms like this. And so, if you're a first-time person raising money, you can get really depressed because, you've tried four different firms and they said no. Of course they're going to say no, because just the statistics of it is so hard to break through. But but there are a lot of us out there, so you do kind of end up getting funded, hopefully.
What about deal flow? Where do you have scouts? You guys have only a certain number of eyes and ears out there internally. You have people out there. You see a lot of deals, but you want to see the right ones, right? You want to pick
Correct.
The right. You want to write the right 5 or 10 checks per year. So if you have the inside scoop from Jason Calacanis or somebody out there who knows you guys, can text you and go, look, I found the one. Does that play? Is that a part of your world?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, and part of it is, being really, a value add to the portfolio companies, because, the more that you're able to support your portfolio, the more that attracts people, that word gets around basically the startup community. And so, it's not, we actually believe it's the right thing to do. We believe it's actually a financially great, I think, to do, is to really support the portfolio companies with lots of help in different ways. But certainly that is something that, if you talk to any VC, and, maybe there's a few out there, but almost all of them will say, deal flow is super important. We don't use scouts, but, we attend lots of demo days, and, when you see one of those demo days and there's like 600 people at the demo day, most of those people are, looking for that next great company that they're going to invest in. Yeah, but that's why they're there, because otherwise they're just not that interesting. No one's going to sit there, for hours.
What does demo day look like today with COVID for you? Are you sitting on a Zoom call? Are there face to face? Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make it easier
Zoom call
in some ways?
So it's different. And the first couple were kind of disasters that I attended. I mean, they had technical difficulties. They lost sound. The video went out. It was not a smooth machine. But recently, the last couple that I've attended have been great. In fact, the last one was so well done. I sort of wonder if this is the new form. They had a it was very well produced. They had these breakout things. You could go talk to the entrepreneurs afterwards. They had it all organized in a very easy way for investors to get additional information, to get an appointment, to meet with them if you wanted to. And it was just an extremely well done setup. And I thought, wow, this may be the future. You're also getting investors from a wider catchment. It's not just, all the Silicon Valley people driving down to, someplace on, in Menlo Park. I assume it was from all over. I couldn't see who also was in there, but there was hundreds of people on the call. But it was very well done. So I do kind of wonder if the future of demo days is much more like that.
So thinking about, the Tesla story a little bit and you and how it affected you, how did it, I mean, our life's experience changes us all in some way, and probably in many ways you're still the same guy, but you learn things that you couldn't know without that success. You've had opportunities that you wouldn't have if you didn't have that success. So I sort of wonder, you're inspired by things and you inspire people in a way that you couldn't have before. So kind of wondering, like, what's it like to be you after having all the success? How have you changed?
Well, it's a lot like me before in the sense that, I had when I left Tesla, I had three little kids, so it was great. I was the stay-at-home dad, and I did the like unpaid Uber driver thing for years. I got involved in local politics here in Woodside, and I was on the school board for 9 years, which was super interesting. And if anyone doesn't believe in the sort of political process, at least at the local level, it really does work, and it just needs you to show up. And I can say that both from somebody who used to show up and also from being on the other side of the table where I was, one of the elected people listening to people who showed up. It really does make a difference, and you can affect change, in your community if you show up. And it sounds, again, I have all these cliches that I've been saying today, but showing up makes all the difference. And so those were opportunities that were great, because partially the success of Tesla and partially the success of the previous company that we had started, which frankly gave us the flexibility financially to start Tesla, was the of our exit from the previous one.
But in terms of like now measuring, so your kids are older now,
You're right.
and what measuring did you ever go about measuring your success and like the value of a life and that kind of thing? So thinking about, how you know whether you've had a good day, a good year, is there certain ways that you sort of kind of look at that or reflect on that, or even maybe you measure yourself in a, on a daily basis?
Yeah, no, I don't. It's like so some people are really into that. I try to do things that I, think make a difference and have some meaning to me. So climate change, I've always been, super focused on environmental causes for whatever reason. I don't know. I remember going to Greenpeace meetings over at Sac State when I must have been about 14 because my mom would have to drive me to the, I was by far the youngest, person there at these Greenpeace meetings, which I do enjoy because I don't know if you have them in Sacramento, but in the pre-COVID times, there would be these people with clipboards for Greenpeace trying to get you to sign up. And they're always about 25. And I'd be like,
I've seen it in front of Whole Foods.
yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And I would go, and I would say, oh, I've been a member since before you were born. What's a little depressing now is that sometimes I can look at them and say, I've been a member, I think probably before your parents were born. Like it's getting a little bit extreme, but so I've always wanted to, you know, I've always done things that I, you know, cared about. And actually, it was one of the reasons we started Tesla, was because Martin and I both really cared about that topic. You know, we cared about climate change, and it was something that we could do. It was our day. We could do it in our day job, basically. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to do it at night, you know, and after work, right?
Yeah.
It was. In fact, I remember driving I was stuck in traffic, oddly, driving to our office one time, and there was some new data that had just come out that was looking terrible. And I thought, oh my God, you know, we really have got to get on top of this. And I thought, oh, right, I just have to get to work, because that's actually what I'm doing. I just need to get, I'm, you know, just stuck in traffic, but as soon as I'm through traffic, I'm going to be actually doing something about that. And likewise, being on the school board, you know, I care about education. Obviously, I had three little kids in school, so that became, you know, like super interesting. And I'm still involved. I'm on the board of a nonprofit that looks at public education and sort of underserved communities and how to improve that, how to improve education for underserved communities in the public school system.
Yeah. So working on things, you know, beyond yourself, so giving back along the way. So important, I think, for people that have had this kind of success. So I want to give you a chance to, you know, I don't want to keep you here all, I would like to keep you here all day, but to make, to respect your time, maybe just some closing thoughts, lessons learned, advice to the next co-founder of a great company.
Well, you know, as we've been talking about, you should do things that you care about. Because starting a company is really hard. So it's going to take all your time. It's going to take more time than you thought you had. And you had better care about the outcome, you know, more than just it's got money in it, because the money just isn't enough. You really want to do something that you care about. And it can be something silly. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, some global changing thing. It can be, you know, there was a company we saw that years ago, that they were making chicken coops, basically, really, you know, fancy chicken coops. And they really cared about chickens. They were super into chicken welfare. Awesome. I mean, it wasn't really a venture scale company, but, you know, like, but it's they cared about that topic really deeply. That's how they came to it. And I'm sure that they were successful in doing that. So I'm just a big believer in finding things that, you know, that you care about at some level. And let's see, is there any other wise things? Oh, don't be afraid to reinvent yourself. So Martin and I had never worked in the car industry, nor had we ever, our previous venture was in electronic publishing. We had never worked in the publishing industry. And in between, I worked in the, you know, sort of the internet plumbing industry, if you will, the routing industry, which I had never done before. It's okay to reinvent yourself. You just won't be very good at it right away. You know, it takes a little while to figure out things, and you have to study it, and you have to really decide, okay, well, I need to learn everything about this thing in order to be successful. But, you know, don't be afraid, you know, of changing tact, because it's, otherwise it's boring. You know, I lose interest eventually. I have to do something else.
So is for now, in terms of reinvention, are you going through that now at all? Are you doing any reinventing?
Well, in some ways, the VC thing is reinvention. So that's, I've only done it for a little over a year. And unfortunately, in the venture world, the feedback loops of what you're doing take a lot longer. You know, you put your money in, and then it takes a while to understand whether that was the right choice or the wrong choice. So I'm new to that field, so I'm learning a lot.
Well, you've shared a lot today. Obviously, Tesla is known throughout. And Mark, I just can't thank you enough. I feel honored and privileged to have you spend some time with us today. I wish you luck in your new reinvention. And I know it's not luck that brought you Elon Musk and the success of Tesla, but and I'm sure it won't be luck that brings you the success of your Sparrow Ventures endeavor. But again, thank you. And I do wish you the best. And if you're ever visiting your brother in Loomis, hey, that's where I hang out. So maybe swing by and say hello.